Let me begin tonight by doing one thing I intended to do last night and didn't get a chance to, ran out of time. And then tonight will be bits and pieces. Last night was more formal and organized. Tonight's bits and pieces, so just be aware of that. I'll be taking some leaps in thought, but I'll try to pull you along with me as I go. I was making the point last night, one of my major arguments, that one of the causes for the never-ending battle between the sexes, which is, in a sense, what it is and what has gone on from the dawn of time, has to do partly, of course, with our fallen nature, but then it also has to do with very real differences in the way in which men and women were created. Trying to make the point that the man is dominated by ego, the sense of self, and the need to project that self into the world, and hence take action in the world. The woman is dominated by her will, getting what she wants, and dominating, and they're very different. I don't know how many of you have read The October Angelus, but I bring this up because I'm just going to give you a couple little excerpts from this. The article is entitled, the article is given a quotation. This apparently was an actual phrase said by a young traditional Catholic man to a young traditional Catholic woman that he was courting. And it's the title of the argument. Do you like to cook? Great! I like to eat. And then the article is subtitled, "And Other Things Not to Say and Do While Seeking a Wife." The editor of the magazine prints a letter received from a young traditional woman who tells about the perils of trying to find a good traditional man to marry. There are amazing stories in here. I'll just give a couple. You could go look up the article and read the rest of them. It's written by a concerned lady. And she's talking, from what my friends and I have seen, I'm quoting the young woman, we think most traditional Catholic guys need something much more blunt than articles on St. Thomas Aquinas philosophy. I was telling some friends about my dating experience with traditional Catholic men, and they thought it would be a good idea to relate these stories to a priest of the Society of St. Pius X. So she writes, she accumulates these unhappy experiences, writes them down, sends them in. Just a couple of them. Now, I want you to keep one thing in mind because there is a common theme even as I read through these examples. The common theme is what the woman is seeking is some sort of attention that may turn into love. She is seeking the male for a moment to give up his own ego and pay some attention to her. Okay? The male is looking for a woman who will bolster that ego. What do we have? It's the problem I presented last night. The man wants somehow to be out in the world and get recognition. The woman wants what she wants, which is a man. There is a clash. The only way this can be healed is what we saw at the end of the play. The man sacrificing the self in loving the other, in loving the wife, and the woman aligning her will so that what she wants is to be obedient to her husband. But listen to some of these. These are one guy referred to me by a priest, I'm just quoting here, sent four photos of himself in his first or second letter. Two of the photos were clipped strangely. It didn't take a PhD in psychology to discern that he had cut his ex-girlfriend out of the photos. Now, point being, what was the guy thinking of when he did the clipping and mailed it? She'll get to see what I look like. What does the young woman see when she receives it? He's not just interested in me. There have been others! It's absolutely an impossible situation. Why? Out of a kind of thoughtlessness, I'd say on both parts, a lack of understanding. What's going on? I love this. A guy in his late 30s, a traditional Catholic for over 15 years, flew up to meet me for the first time. He overslept and missed his plane for the trip, so he arrived late. Okay, didn't really care about me, or he would have been on time. That's implicit, but she doesn't say it. I went to his hotel, and when he pulled his rental car up to the lobby to meet me, he handed me the car keys and said, "Why don't you drive?" There are a number of these. There's the man who on the first date suggests they go rock climbing. But this is the classic. This is the one. You want an example of the male ego run amok. Listen to this one. This is another young woman writing to a guy. They were both traditional Catholics and also had a strong common interest in athletics, especially running. The young lady ended the correspondence after he wrote this. "I always told myself I would have to marry a runner so that I could breed children who grew up to marry runners so one day enough genes were passed down to make an Olympian." It's two pages of horror stories. You feel very sorry for the young woman. However, about three nights before I came over here to do this lecture, I got a call from a traditionalist male who had just received his Angelus and just read this article. He was livid, absolutely livid, and called me to see if I could suggest names of young traditionalist men I knew. And he's putting together a response because he's going to show her that it's not so easy to find a good traditionalist young woman to marry as well. Well, the battle of the sexes is going on in the Angelus now. So if you don't think you're going to run into this, think again. It's out there. And the point being this, I have no doubt, it's very clear, the young woman who sent this letter and the young men that she was dating are probably traditional Catholics. The young man who called me, who was in a lather and is about to write a vehement response, is a good traditional Catholic. It's not, in fact, but I handed that name over instantly, and it resulted, I was told later, in a 4-hour phone conversation. But we shouldn't get into personalities here. The point being, this is simply an ongoing problem. It's an ongoing problem that can easily be solved, I think. Well, no, it's not. There's no easy solution, but can begin to approach a solution by keeping one thing in mind. What do you say to the young men? Love your wife. If you are courting a young woman, pay sufficient attention to her so that she feels as if she is the most important person in the world for you. Women need love. What do you say to the young woman? Be obedient. Be obedient. Let your will coincide with your husband's will. And if it means going rock climbing, maybe not on the first date, maybe saying, "How I would love to go rock climbing, maybe not right now because I need to get in shape or something." You know, both have to make allowances. And the allowance that has to be made is in line with what Paul says in that letter to the Ephesians. Because what the women need to curb the will is obedience to the higher authority, to the husband. What men need in order to keep a happy home is to love the wives, because the wives need love. And there it is. So it's out there. You're going to run into it. You're going to see it. You're going to be dealing with this. There's no getting away from it. What I would like to do, because I didn't have time last night, is look very closely at the final speech. I'm going to do it for a couple of reasons. One, to pull together many of the ideas I presented last night. Two, to look at how Shakespeare presents character, even in an early play such as this. Shakespeare has created in this and populated an enormous little world in his plays. There's one critic that says, after God, Shakespeare hath created most. And as sort of a created world populated with hundreds of interesting personalities, there's something to that. I want to take a look at how he creates. And the other thing we're going to do along the way is just a little bit of a basic poetry lesson. Well, don't worry, I won't go into it big time, but in order to get to the core of the character, always with Shakespeare, you have to look at the language. What Shakespeare realized is who we are is conveyed and to a large extent created by the words we use. One of the things that makes us human is our ability to possess and use language. What makes us specifically human in terms of personality has to do with how we express ourselves, the language we use. And it is through his remarkable ability to define a character through language that he creates those characters, creates those individuals. And that comes through the poetry. So we'll take a look at that. Now, something I didn't say last night, speaking about the last scene, and in order to get to the last speech, a quick look at the last scene. Act 5, scene 2. We finally come to the wedding feast. It's appropriate because there will be the celebration of a marriage here. The feast is for Lucentio and Bianca. But the real marriage that will be celebrated here is that of Petruchio and Caterina. And that marriage, as a good marriage, will be made public at this wedding feast. What will happen, ironically, is the couple celebrating this wedding feast, in whose honor it is given, will be shown to have a rocky future. There are going to be troubles ahead. And it's very odd because notice who begins the scene. Lucentio begins the scene by saying, "At last, though long, our jarring notes agree, and time it is when raging war is done." Boy, is he wrong. But he's not going to know it till the end of the scene. His trouble is just beginning. He is giving what is a standard conventional view. I've won my bride. There are no more problems. Our fathers are in agreement with this marriage. Here we are married. Big feast. Everything's fine. Mistaken assumption, as is sadly the case in many marriages entered into on such a shallow level as the Lucentio-Bianca marriage. It is a shallow marriage in many ways. They're sitting. The banquet begins. And the widow insults Petruchio. Petruchio is said, "Hortensio is afeard of you," to the widow, and the widow says, "He that is giddy thinks the world turns round." Okay? You're referring to yourself, buddy. You may put that on my husband, but you're actually referring to yourself. Caterina defends her husband. "Mistress, how mean you that? Thus I conceive by him." There's a little exchange. Caterina, "He that is giddy thinks the world turns round. I pray you tell me what you meant by that. Your husband, being troubled with a shrew, measures my husband's sorrow by his woe. And now you know my meaning." She explains, "I insulted your husband." Caterina is very proper. We're at a formal, dignified wedding feast. And she says, "A very mean meaning." It's a wonderful comeback. Wonderful. "Right, I mean you. And I mean, indeed, respecting you." And Petruchio says, "To her, Kate." Hortensio says, "To her, widow." And we expect a cat fight. You know, expected them to claw each other's eyes out and roll on the ground. But it doesn't happen. Although Petruchio says, 100 marks, my Kate puts her down. Please notice it's a joke. The scene begins with, I'll bet on my wife. Okay? If there's a wrestling match, I bet on my wife. And yet, the scene is going to end with a very serious bet. A very serious bet of a different kind. Not a kind of, which cat will win the cat fight, but something that is much higher in its implications. Now, the ladies leave the room. The gentlemen begin talking about their wives and the wager. The wager is created. I went over last night. He had 20 crowns, I'll venture so much of my hawk or hound, but 20 times so much upon my wife. 100 then, content, a match, 'tis done. and the wager is made. Lucentio begins, his wife refuses to come. At that moment, it's clear there's trouble in the marriage. She is simply not going to obey her husband's commands. Hortensio sends for the widow. She will not come. She bids you come to her. And it's not just disobedience. It is a complete reversal of roles. The wife giving orders to the husband and expecting obedience from the husband. Which again, as we said last night, is appropriate in this relationship. Hortensio is effeminate, weak, and unmanly. And the widow is tough and strong. She's the modern woman, if you will. Sadly, vision of the modern woman. Petruchio, Grumio, go to your mistress, say I command her come to me. Okay? I know her answer, what? She will not, Petruchio says, the fouler fortune mine and there an end. Well, if she doesn't, I'm in real trouble. Fouler fortune, I've lost some money. Fouler fortune, the future doesn't look bright for me if she doesn't come. As soon as he says it, enter Caterina. Now, that is the first of three tests of obedience he gives to his wife. He calls her, tells her to come, she arrives. Okay? There is a second. Actually, I in a way you could say there are four. The next one. Petruchio asks, where is your sister and Hortensio's wife? Caterina says, they sit conferring by the parlor fire. And he gives another order to her. Go fetch them hither. If they deny to come, swinge me them soundly forth unto their husbands. Go and get them. If they won't come, you can finally do what you want to do. Give them a good pounding and make them come. Now, we've known from the beginning that Caterina has some resentment against Bianca. Zeffirelli in the film makes it graphic as she's got the whip and is going at her. But the fact of the matter is, Petruchio now gives his blessing to his wife and says, I order you, you'll get them. If they don't come, then beat up your sister and make her come. And there has just been the fight with the widow that was stopped. And now Petruchio is saying, and if the widow gives you any trouble, swinge me her soundly for it, okay? You make her come. Here's your chance. You have my full approval. In fact, I order you to pound on her if necessary to bring her into this room. Please notice what's happened. He is now giving his wife orders to do something that deep inside in her heart of hearts she's wanted to do. Get her sister that she suspects of being a coy little unpredictable and flirtatious minx, and to get the widow, who is simply manly and bossy and has a tongue and deserves some punishment. Now, please notice what happens. Apparently, there's not a fight off stage. Caterina goes and orders them, and they come. Meaning, among the women, there is a hierarchy. And the woman who is obedient to her husband gets a kind of obedience from other women, at least a kind of respect. They show up. They come in. They arrive. I'm at line 120. Petruchio, see where she comes and brings your froward wives as prisoners to her womanly persuasion. I love the phrase, her womanly persuasion. We don't know what went on. I don't think there was a fight. Then notice this. This is not in the film. Catherine, that cap of yours becomes you not. Off with that bauble. Throw it underfoot. And she does so. We have a public, private moment that takes us back to that moment in Petruchio's home when he destroyed the gown that she was to wear to the wedding feast and then destroyed the cap she was to wear. And when he said, the cap's no good, forget it, she says, I will have that cap. Women wear such caps, and he destroys it. Now we have a private moment where he's saying, prove yourself. I give you a note. Destroy that cap you're wearing. I won't destroy it. You destroy it. You destroy it because I tell you to. And do it publicly. And she does. And the widow says, Lord, let me never have a cause to sigh till I be brought to such a silly pass. I hope I never come to the point where my husband orders me to destroy my clothing and I do it. But at that moment, there is a special bond created between Petruchio and Caterina. Please notice, there are now three commands he's given. She's obeyed all three. Bianca, fie, what a foolish duty call you this. And Lucentio says, I would your duty were as foolish too. And he admits defeat. Boy, I wish in duty-wise you were as foolish as she is in obeying her husband. And it's Lucentio's quiet way of saying, oh boy, I'm in trouble. Boy, I wish I'd married a woman who would obey me like Caterina's now obeying Petruchio, but apparently I didn't. The wisdom of your duty, fair Bianca, hath cost me 100 crowns since supper time. it's a wonderful moment. The response, the more fool you for laying on my duty. Whoa! Big trouble ahead. Big trouble ahead. Okay? And that's sort of the last we see of that happy relationship. That pretty romance that began in Act One. Whoa! There they are. And then, Petruchio, hearing that remark from the sweet, fair, kind, lovely, little, soft, gentle Bianca, gives his last command. Caterin, I charge thee, tell these headstrong women what duty they do owe their lords and husbands. Please notice, this is wonderful. This is not now saying, now you declare publicly what you owe to me. He is saying, no, you've proven yourself 3 times. You have proven yourself an obedient wife 3 times. You teach these women a lesson now. And that's the last order he gives, and she obeys. The widow, come, you're mocking. Willie will have no telling. Come on, I say, and first begin with her. Instruct the widow first. She shall not, I say she shall, and first begin with her, says Petruchio again. And Caterina turns on the widow and says, fie, fie. It's wonderful. It's a great moment. What's she doing? She's obeying her husband, but please notice what has happened. Her will is now consistent with her husband's will, and he has just ordered her again to do exactly what she wants. Tell that woman off. I order you as your husband to tell that woman off. And Caterina is ready for the moment. Fie! Fie! Unknit that threatening, unkind brow. It is a command. It is a command. And we now have the proper obedient wife commanding the disobedient wife. We now, once again, within the circle of the women, there is a smaller hierarchy. And who deserves to be listened to? The one who is the wife as a wife should be. And possesses wifely authority, even over other women. Why? Because she is fulfilling her proper role, as defined by her husband. And as defined clearly, by God's design. We'll come to that in a moment. Now, I need to put a little something on the board. Some of you have come across this before. Shakespearean blank verse. Most of Shakespeare's plays written in blank verse. That is a term that simply means the poetic form which is unrhymed iambic pentameter. What does that mean? It simply means there are 5 feet in the line. To measure this line of poetry that Shakespeare uses, it is pentameter, 5. That means there are 5 feet in the line, and iambic tells us what comprises each foot. 2 syllables, a short syllable, an unaccented syllable, followed by an accented syllable. I'm just going to put it up here so you get a sense of it. And I'm going to look at another line. Look at the 3rd line of Caterina's speech. It's a line of perfect iambic pentameter. We count the syllables. To wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. I have 10 syllables. It divides by 2, 5 feet. And we have the absolutely perfect pattern. Please notice where the accents fall. Let me just exaggerate it. To wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. the norm. Got it? It's really quite simple. But here's the pattern. This is for unaccented, that's for accented, okay? It's unaccented, accented. Short, long. And in order to get a full foot of iambic pentameter, we need five of these groupings. Short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. 1 foot, 2 foot, 3, 4, 5, end of line. Okay? What you're going to find occasionally is an 11th syllable that somehow has to be fit into the line somewhere, or if it comes at the end of the line, a single unaccented syllable, it's called, and this drives my poor female students crazy, a feminine or weak ending. Sexism in poetry. But there it is. That's what it's called. Now, that's the standard pattern. Please look at the first line of Katharina's speech. The reason for setting a pattern or a rhythm is always to break the pattern. You have a structure there. You have order. It is there so that you can ring variations on it. And please notice the first foot of her first line. Phi, phi. And what we get right away? Two accented syllables. How does the speech begin? With great strength. What is she talking about? Being feminine. It's a wonderful little contradiction. And what we have is Katharina has not changed her personality. She is still a strong woman in many ways, with a strong personality. She is, however, a good wife. She's giving her lesson, and we get this. Phi, phi. Unknit that threatening, unkind brow. And notice what happens at the end of the line. Phi, phi. Unknit that threatening, unkind brow. And we suddenly get great strength at the end of the line as well. Not to mention the other thing that a great poet does, which is line up the sounds so that the sounds, the music of the words, carry much of the meaning. Listen again. Phi, phi, unknit that threatening, unkind brow. And because of the vowel sounds and the heavy accent, the heavy consonants, you have to slow down the line as you say it as it comes to its end. There is power in the language. This is a great poet at work. A great poet also does one other thing. Words carry two different kinds of meaning. Words carry what are called denotative meanings, okay? Denotative meanings. Dictionary definition. Exactly what the word means. Words also carry what are called connotative meanings. Additional possibilities that sort of accumulate around words, and poets will use those, even if it's not a direct meaning, a poet will play off other possibilities. I say the word lemon to you, and you think of that round yellow fruit that is very sour if you bite into it. Okay? But even if that's what I mean, and I speak of something that's really a lemon and absolutely lousy, you could carry a connotative meaning. The word could carry another meaning, which is a rotten used car. Okay? Boy, I bought a real lemon. If someone was thinking only denotatively, the person would think, you bought a bad piece of fruit? And you're saying, no, a real lemon, which has come, there's this other meaning carried with it that means a bad used car. Well, where does that come from? We don't know. But the word lemon, for some reason, now carries that additional meaning, that other meaning, okay? Poets will play off other possible meanings in order to enrich the words they're using. Let me give you a couple of examples from what's happening here in the very beginning of the speech. Phi, phi, unknit that threatening, unkind brow. Okay, what's she saying? You have your eyebrows furrowed. You're making an ugly face. Cut it out. I mean, that's what she's saying. Please notice the verb, unknit. And suddenly we have a connotative, it means separate them, take it apart. That's the denotative meaning. Get those eyebrows apart. Don't squinch them together and look ugly at me, lady. But she is using a word that is loaded with what connotations? Domestic feminine activity. Knitting. Knitting. And what is she saying? She's get those brows apart, but at the same time she's saying, don't you dare knit anything. It's a connotative meaning. It's carrying an extra possibility. It enriches the possibilities. And Shakespeare, this is early in his career, and he will do this sort of thing constantly. Constantly. Unknit that threatening, unkind brow and dart not scornful glances from those eyes. And don't you throw ugly glances, okay, at, not me, but notice, to wound thy lord, at your husband. Don't you give dirty looks to your husband. But dart, quite literally means don't you give glances. But dart suggests a weapon as well. A pointed weapon that hurts, that can be destructive. And dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord. Okay, I'll just say the phrase again. To wound thy lord. It means to hurt your husband. If I say it enough, particularly in a seminary setting, the words carry a connotation. Don't you dare behave like that woman, because when you behave that way, you wound your lord. That is not what it's saying directly, but it's hovering there, and I'll show you some other examples in the speech. Shakespeare lived in a time of religious turmoil. He could not discuss these things openly, but there are times when he buries suggestions. And what we're going to get throughout is the notion that we are viewing here with what these women are doing, disorder. A taking apart of the structure and ordering of the world the way it's supposed to be. Dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. Please notice we get a kind of progression. I won't take the time to go through it. Lord, king, governor. But notice one other thing. We begin with what? Unknit your brow and stop shooting glances from your eye. And in those two lines, please notice the word brow appears where in the line? Right above the eyes. We have the hierarchy, if you will, of the human face. There's order in the face. The brow is above the eyes. If you look at those two lines, the last word and the first two lines of the speech, what do you find? Things in their proper place. The brow is right above the eyes. It's just it's a wonderful little moment. He couldn't have meant that. Well, he put him there. And then we get into the whole question of the intent of the artist. Well, we don't know what he intends. We don't have a signed document saying, yeah, I thought that was kind of cute. I end the first line with brow, the next one with eyes, the eyes right below the brow. That's the way it's supposed to be. It's a speech about order, and I'm ordering the lines. We don't know he did that or thought that, but it's there, and it's appropriate, and we're into the realm of genius. The rest of us couldn't do that kind of thing. We could write something. It just wouldn't turn out that way. It wouldn't be quite as interesting. It's the reason why those of us who spend years and years working with Shakespeare just keep finding more and more. It just keeps opening up. It just gets more and more interesting. Okay. Onward. Now we get the reason why not. Don't shoot those looks. Don't you do that. It blots thy beauty as frosts do bite the meads. It's just wonderful. We go to an image from nature, but notice there is kindness in Katharina now. What's she saying to the widow? You're beautiful. There is beauty about you. You are destroying that beauty. You are blighting your own beauty. In the same way that frost can come in and kill the living meadow. And we have an image of what time of the year? It's an image of winter. Anybody who does any growing knows that worry about when that first frost will come and kill things that are still growing. My father has spent the last 2 weeks hauling geraniums inside every night because he knows that frost is coming and it'll be the end of those. It will blight those geranium plants if the frost hits. But the difference here is, this is the woman doing it to herself. She is blighting, she is choosing to destroy her own beauty. And we get the wonderful little alliteration, beginning words with the same sounds. It blots thy beauty. It blots thy beauty. The double B is a wonderful moment. What does it do? Strong sounds again. There's still strength in Catherine, even as she compliments the widow. It blots thy beauty as frosts do bite the meads. We had wounding, we had the knitting, we had the wounding, and now we have biting. And it's an animal image, okay? Connotation, one thing biting another, savagery, disorder, meanness, all carried in the words. Confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds. It will ruin your reputation, just as certainly as a turbulent wind can blow in and destroy fair buds. And what we thought was a winter image now becomes what? An image of springtime. And there is a wonderful shift in the whole attitude if you're looking at the imagery, and that which seemed deadly, that is the coming of winter, the destruction of life in the cycle of nature, we have mistaken, and it can be something that suggests spring. But now it is a destruction of new growth, the beginning of new life. And again, what? You're doing it to yourself. By the way, a little side note, this is one of the ways in which we can date some of these plays. Sonnet 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May. Confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds. Same image, very close, very close. We can assume this play was somehow at least gestating at the same time he was writing the sonnets, which is why I tend to put it about 1591, 1592. There are little games you can play like that to try to figure out when he was actually writing, because these images would stick in his mind and keep coming back. Confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds, and in no sense is meet or amiable. It is neither proper nor pleasant. It's neither orderly nor polite. It's a wonderful phrase, and We can always pause and speculate on individual words. We wouldn't get through the speech. Now we shift to a different image. Please notice how these images are moving rapidly, one after another, in the speech. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled. Women have always been associated with water, all the way back to Greek mythology. If you know the great Botticelli painting, of Venus rising up out of the sea. There is always that sense of water. Why? Because it's life-giving. It is life-giving. That is hinted at here. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. You stir up the fountain and suddenly you don't have the lovely water. You've got mud. You've got muck. You can't see through it. What is it? It becomes muddy, ill-seeming, thick. Bereft of beauty. That is a gorgeous line in and of itself, but please notice what the line is doing. Compare it with the previous line of poetry. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled. And we have, it's pretty much a regular line of iambic pentameter. The next line, we get the line stirred up, thick and muddy. Muddy. He reverses the pattern. And what we go from, I won't do too much technicality here, but be aware of the word. The line begins with a trochaic foot, muddy, muddy. And we get an inversion of the proper poetic foot, muddy, ill-seeming, ill-seeming. Thick, bereft of beauty. And we get a feminine ending in this foot. We have a line that looks irregular, although it becomes regular as it goes along, because he's using something else. Anytime a poet breaks a line with a comma, a period, a semicolon, it's called a caesura, and he's breaking the flow of the line. Compare the line before it with this one. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. And suddenly you can feel those starts and stops and hesitations, and what's smack in the middle of the line? The word thick. And what he's doing, muddy, ill-seeming, thick. We can't even tell if the line becomes regular because the way he's breaking it up with the punctuation. All we know is that something's gone wrong, something is amiss, and it's amiss in the poetry. At the same time, he is having the character talk about what's amiss in the way the woman is treating her husband. And what do we get? We get that fountain that doesn't look right, loses its beauty, and while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. You keep looking that way, honey, nobody's going to come near you or want to come near you. But the fountain, the image of the fountain, which is the image of the wife, is that which should attract, draw by its beauty, and do what? Refresh. Renew life. The wife, the image is the wife, is to the husband as the fountain is to the thirsty traveler. And that image, by the way, is going to come back soon in the speech, with the image of the husband traveling. So he's already preparing for something that's going to come later. Now, please notice all that we've looked at so far, this whole first section of the speech, about the first eight or nine lines. One idea, and that is a criticism of the widow. Don't be this way, because when you're this way, this is what it's like. And then notice the shift in thought from the wife, who is not being a good wife, an obedient wife, even an attractive wife, to the husband. We get a shift. We get the bond. We begin with the wife, address to the wife, and then what connects? What's the next part of the speech? Thy husband is thy Lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign. We get a list of comparisons there. In the whole notion of Elizabethan thought at the time Shakespeare was writing, was an idea that was often called the great chain of being, which said that everything in the universe was ordered in a very particular way. And it was called a chain because there were links. There were links from one thing above to the thing below. And it stretched from God himself down to inanimate minerals, a hunk of rock. But you could go through the whole universe and everything in that universe, God to the angels, to man, to woman, to animals, to plants, down to rocks, were ordered in some way. And you could even make divisions within those. Everything had its proper place. And because it was a chain, everything depended on the thing above it and below it. So that if you disorder any link in that chain, you are taking the whole chain apart. You are going to cause extreme disorder. Thy husband is thy Lord. He's above you. If you're going to pretend to be a lady, the lady must have a Lord. The Lord is above the lady. Thy life. If you, now being married, separate yourself from your husband, you will cut off the source of your life. Thy keeper. All that animal imagery through the whole play. This is the one who cares for you, who takes care of, who watches over you, keeps you, but not just in the sense of maintaining you in home, but also watches guard over you so you don't get out and attack some poor innocent out there. Okay? And there is that hint of, I know you're a wild beast. You need a keeper. It's a wonderful word, thy keeper. Thy head. And the head is at the top of the body. The head is primary. Your husband is the head. If you dissociate yourself or rebel against your head, you are lopping your head off and your body won't do you any good. Thy sovereign. And the sovereign, the prince, oversees those below him, oversees the people below him. Each of these things suggests something else. The Lord needs a lady or servants. We can run down the list. Every single thing is dependent, is linked with something else. Thy husband is these things. She goes on to explain it further. One that cares for thee. By the way, please notice, quickly, the last thing in that list is thy sovereign. Your husband is to you as the prince is to the people he governs. Well, of course, one of the people being governed by the sovereign is the husband. Implicit in that is the husband also has obligations, higher obligations. So we begin with thy Lord. We end with thy sovereign, which suggests there's somebody above the Lord. And yes, you may look up to your husband, but your husband has to look up to the sovereign. There's someone above him that he owes obedience to. He is not just a free spirit imposing what he wants on you, not by any means. He is part of this much larger picture. Let me just take this minute. I brought this other play with me. Those of you that have complete Shakespeare's, note this speech. It's in Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, written probably about 10 years after Taming of the Shrew. If there is one speech in Shakespeare that sums up what the man believed from the beginning of his career to the end, it's in Troilus and Cressida, Act 1, Scene 3. A long speech by Ulysses. I won't go through the whole speech. It's at about line 75, approximately line 75, in Troilus and Cressida, Act 1, Scene 3. I'm just going to give you a little bit of it. This is the same point developed at length that Catherine is making in her speech to the widow. There is order, and you have to observe that order. This is Ulysses speaking. The heavens themselves, the planets, and this center, that is the earth, observe degree, priority, and place, insisture, course, proportion, season, form, office, and custom in all line of order. The whole universe is arranged according to a predetermined order. And everything in that universe runs according to a pre-designed order. And therefore is the glorious planet Sol, the sun, in noble eminence enthroned and sphered amidst the other, whose medicinal eye corrects the influence of evil planets and posts, like the commandment of a king, sun's check to good and bad. And within that order, there is a central authority that commands everything. In this speech, it's the sun. But when the planets in evil mixture to disorder wander, what plagues and what portents, what mutiny, what raging of the sea, shaking of earth, commotion in the winds, flights, changes, horrors, divert and crack, rend and deracinate the unity and married calm of states quite from their fixture. Please notice the marriage image used in there, referring to the planets. Oh, when degree is shaped, which is the ladder of all high designs, the enterprise is sick. How could communities, degrees in schools, and brotherhoods in cities, peaceful commerce from dividable shores, the primogenity and due of birth, prerogative of age, crowns, scepters, laurels, but by degree stand in authentic place? Take but degree away. Untune that string and hark what discord follows. Each thing meets in mere repugnancy. If you take away that order, there will be total universal disorder And that disorder will be a battle of every element in it fighting against every other element. It's a perfect description in one sense of the modern world. There it becomes a grand universal vision. In this play, it starts with a vision of marriage. But it's something he believed from the start to the finish. And in almost all of his plays, when there is disorder, it's because someone is fighting against that which was ordained to be. Now, we'll notice this continue. The idea continues. We're back to Catherine talking about the husband. Thy husband is thy Lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee and for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor, both by sea and land. To watch the night in storms, the day in cold, whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe. And craves no other tribute at thy hands, but love, fair looks, and true obedience. Too little payment for so great a debt. We have there a full understanding of the man's role, to be out in the world. It's a full understanding now, in a way, of her own husband. The man is out there doing men's work that has to be done, and it's hard work. But please notice the wonderful buried connotations again. The man is out there committing his body to painful labor. Painful labor, says the woman. And she's giving a wonderful vision of, but we're at home comfortable, all warm and cozy and comfortable. But in using the phrase, committing one's body to painful labor, there is implied the fact of why the woman's at home. Yeah, she may not have to go out and fight in the world, but she has a different job, a different task. And he's out there committing his body to painful labor in the world. And implied, not stated, but certainly hinted at, is what the woman's doing at home. Thou liest warm at home, secure and safe, which is absolutely true. And we get the two different domains of the proper ordering of male and female. The man out in the world doing the work, the woman at home. And yes, secure and safe, but of course what she is doing is building the nest so that when the young arrive through painful labor, there will be a home. And when her husband returns, there will be a home. He craves no other tribute but love, fair looks, and true obedience. That has got to be a slap at Bianca. There's a slap at Bianca, okay? The scope has moved beyond the widow now. She's talking to her sister as well. I know your game, kid. I know the game you've been playing here. You've just shown your hand. Now, it expands outward again. The wife owes obedience to the husband, such duty as the subject owes the prince. And we're getting the sense of the hierarchy going upward, okay? The woman is not in an unusual position. She is in a place, but each thing in the world, each thing in the universe, the created universe, is in its designated place. It has its proper place. And the wife owes obedience to the husband as the subject owes obedience to the prince, such duty to the prince. Even such a woman oweth to her husband. And when she is froward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, please notice, clarification, he cannot just give any order he wants. He cannot say to her, climb to the roof and throw yourself off. Okay? That is not his honest will, because that is asking her to become part, something, to disorder herself and become and break with other high laws and commands. So that it's got to be, she says it twice, she owes him true obedience, he must exercise his honest will. And there can be questions in how we define those things, but those are important. Those adjectives are important. When she is forward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, what is she but a foul, contending rebel and graceless traitor to her loving Lord? The image of the traitor to the state, okay, was one that would have been immediate for anyone living in London When they left the theater after seeing the play to go home, they could see the heads of the traitors stuck on London Bridge. Okay? And the head image suddenly comes back. Okay, that sense. You want to be a traitor to the state? Fine, you'll get your head lopped off. We'll put it up on the bridge. That's not its natural place. But it's a place where it will be put as a reminder that you violated something so sacred, so important. In becoming a traitor, in seeking disorder in the state, you now have become disordered in your person as punishment. Off goes the head, up it goes on London Bridge, along with all the other traitors. That was an immediate image. The wife who disobeys the husband is like the traitor disobeying the state. And then the phrase, and graceless traitor to her loving Lord. When she disobeys an honest command, she is becoming graceless. She is losing grace. She has become a traitor and a rebel to her loving Lord. And there's that connotation again that I mentioned at the beginning of the speech. Implicit, connotatively, is there is a higher design, and it was designed by a loving Lord who gave us an ordered world to live in. A quick word on feminism and why they are wrong. Feminism, in seeking to move out of the house and assume a position in the world, basically take over what the men couldn't make run and make it work properly, the women are rebelling against God's order. It is, in essence, the voice of the entire sex as they become committed to it saying, non serviam. I will not serve. I will not stay at home, bear children, raise those children, maintain a household, sew and cook and love my children and love my husband and make a good home for him. I will not. And whoever devised that system, God, did it wrong, and I'm going to get it right. It is a rebellion against God's order. So that it is inevitable that it leads to something ultimately satanic. I'm not bearing this child. I don't want it. It interferes with my career. I'm killing it. And instead of worshiping God, one worships Satan. And abortion is the bloody offering of a sacrifice to Satan by those who are saying, non serviam. I will not serve a nature that made me fertile and made me a woman. I will not serve a society created where I am to be at home and create a home for my children and my husband. I will not serve God's order. He got it wrong. I'm going to do it better. Many of them are not aware that that is what they are saying. The best evidence is, as they go out and attempt to do this, they become bad parodies of men. They don't look that good in pants. I mean, forget the other arguments. They just don't look very good in pants. They don't do well climbing up the corporate ladder because they're constantly, when frustrated, crying. There are a few things more pathetic than at the academy to see some upperclassman trying to train a plebe standing shouting at her, "You don't have your uniform on right. Why isn't your uniform on right? Don't you know what uniform is?" And seeing her going, at which point training stops. You can't shout in the face of a weeping young man. It's just pathetic. They are picking up men's bad habits. They're smoking. The lung cancer rate is skyrocketing among women. They're drinking at an unheard of rate. They go out with the girls after work and toss down a few. This is just grotesque. It's just grotesque. It's simply absurd. And they're becoming promiscuous in the way that men, shamefully, too often are promiscuous. What you get is not the women who are redesigning the world. You get women who are trying to parody, who become bad parodies of men at their worst. The fault lies on the men. And for two reasons, and we have them in Hortensio and Lucentio. First, the man who will not be a man, the man who is unmanned, the man who is lacking so in his own sense of self, moral fiber, virtue, that he will not exert his masculinity. And two, the romantic, pie-eyed young goon who just swoons over the beauty. I just described the 19th century in much of art. One reason the women's rebellion broke out in the 20th century is that when the artists took God off the pedestal, they put woman up there. They no longer believed in God, but what would save the world was the beauty of woman. The end of Goethe's Faust. Okay? The eternal feminine leads us upward. Okay? The end of any Wagner opera, where it's somehow the love of the good woman that has triumphed. It's the woman that will save the world. Whether her name is Senta or Elizabeth or, you know, all the way through. It's everywhere in 19th century Romanticism. And the women got mad. Just as Bianca's mad. They may look pretty and flirt and flap their eyelids and, you know, and look coy. But she knows her father was a Hortensio who failed in his job as a man. She's now married to Lucentio, who is just this hopeless romantic who is failing in his job as a man. And she's mad. And that anger comes out after the wedding. We can imagine Bianca saying, forget this, I'm going to go teach at the University of Padua. You stay home and cook the pasta. Okay? That anger is there because there has been disorder. She's grown up in disorder. So that those are the two. The men create it. Because the men are not occupying their proper role. Are not performing their proper function. And then that's what we get. When she is forward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, what is she but a foul, contending rebel and graceless traitor to her loving lord? It's a rich line. It is a line rich with connotation. Please notice what happens. For the first time, Katerina enters the speech. I am ashamed that women are so simple to offer war when they should kneel for peace. I'm one of them. I'm ashamed of my own sex, she says. Says the former warrior, okay? Basically saying, I'm ashamed of you women now. And she knows that because she was one of them. She has done all of this that she's accusing them of. Or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway when they are bound to serve love and obey, and we have the echo of the marriage ceremony. If you married and took that vow, then you'd better live it. And those are the words. And please notice, the poetry does this again. How is obey emphasized? Because it comes at the end of the line, and for one of the first times in the entire speech, he uses a rhyme. Listen. Or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway when they are bound to serve, love, and obey. And he emphasized obey by giving us a rhyme from the end of the line before. Using the poetry, saving the rhyme, and boom, obey has a double punch because it becomes a rhymed word. The poetry working again to make the point. The sound helping to carry the meaning forward, which is what great poetry does. Notice the next line. Now Katerina joins herself with the other women. It was first she addressed them, and then she said, I am ashamed that women are such, and now she says, why are our bodies? And now she becomes one of them. And at this moment, she is humbly joining her sex. And it's not just, here's me telling you this, now it's our. We are all in this together. Why are our bodies soft and weak and smooth, unapt to toil and trouble in the world? but that our soft conditions and our hearts should well agree with our external parts. Another rhyme. Another rhyme. And now it is not just a hierarchy up and down, it is inside outside. The exterior and the interior should be one. There must be harmony between the outside and the inside, which means we were created by our Creator, soft, weak, and smooth, and therefore so should our hearts be soft, gentle and loving. In order for there to be that compatibility, so there can be no disjunction between the external and the internal. Harmony, harmony within the self. Then she attacks again. Come, come, you forward and unable worms. Please notice the repeated pattern. Fie, fie. Come, come. It's taking a pattern from the beginning of the speech. My mind hath been as big as one of yours. Okay. I thought like you did. I had these big thoughts just like you do. My heart is great, my reason happily more. I love it. Perhaps I was a little more intelligent than you were. That's one reading of it. The other reading is, perhaps I had better reason to be angry than you have. Interesting possibilities there. Wonderful thing. If I were directing the play, it's something you'd have the actress play with in various possibilities. Who does she address the words to? How does she say it? What does she mean? Who does she look at when she says it? Maybe at her father. All sorts of wonderful possibilities there. My heart is great, my reason happily more, to bandy word for word and frown for frown. I was just like you were. Please notice what she's doing. She's entering the common lot. I understand where you're coming from. I was like that. I've been there. I was just like you, perhaps worse, perhaps with better reason. But now I see our lances are but straws. Please notice the use of the word our again and how it rings through these lines. Our strength as weak, our weakness past compare, that seeming to be most which we indeed least are. So we're going to pretend that we're strong and tough and we'll fight the guys and we'll beat them. We're not that. Look at us. Look at us, okay? They'll never let us play football. It's not going to happen. We're just not built for it. If they wanted, they can crush us. They can kill us. So why are we pretend we're big and tough and strong and brave and we'll knock them? We can't look at us. That seeming to be most which we indeed least are. Look at that line. Count the syllables. We've got 12 syllables. We have a line of iambic hexameter. And as she says, we can't be that which we are not. The line swells an extra foot. In making herself totally humble and accepting her state, the poetry becomes more. And she's given an extra foot. That seeming to be most which we indeed least are. 6 feet. Well, he just had to write it that way. Nonsense. Drop the word indeed. We've got a perfect line of iambic pentameter. He was smart enough, he could have dropped that one word. And suddenly, by becoming less, seemingly, but not really, just accepting her proper place, she does become more. Then veil your stomachs, for it is no boot, and place your hands below your husband's foot. Okay, ladies, now prove yourself real women, real wives, give up this foolish nonsense and put your hand beneath your husband's foot. You kneel down, you bend down, you do an act of complete humility, put your hand under his foot. Please notice we've got the chain hanging by the hand under the husband's foot. And if we take it in the Elizabethan sense of the great chain, I'm fine as long as I hang on. What happens if I let go? Okay, down I go. And the critics have puzzled why the hand on the foot. It makes absolute sense to me. That's how you get a chain. And now notice what happens. Petruchio gave her this order. You tell those women how they should treat their husbands. She has done that thoroughly. She has included herself. And now she said, now you go kneel down and do this. And then a gift not commanded by her husband, in token of which duty, Okay, ladies, I'll show you what this is about. I've explained that duty to you, in token of which duty, if he please, that is my husband, my hand is ready. May it do him ease. And she kneels and puts her hand under Petruchio's foot without his asking, demanding. It is a gift freely given. Why, there's a wench. Come on and kiss me, Kate. And with the obedience of the woman, what comes from the man? Love. Love in action. What's the last action of Petruchio? An action of love. Why, come on and kiss me, Kate. It's glorious comedy. It's glorious comedy. It's thoughtful, it's intellectual, and I call it Christian comedy. Even though Shakespeare couldn't explicitly talk about it, the ordering, the vision of order, the vision of hierarchy, the vision of authority, the ramifications, the echoes all the way through of Ephesians, St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, of obedience and love is everywhere in the play, echoes everywhere through the play. In early work, he would go further. But had he stopped his career after this, he still would have left us a great masterpiece. Thank you very much. There's some time for questions again, if anyone has any. It's very interesting. Many of you know that it goes all the way back to the Middle Ages. We see it in Dante when Dante and Virgil get to the lowest circle of hell, the pilgrim has the vision of Satan. Satan is munching on three bodies, Judas, Brutus, and Cassius. And the image is the absolute worst sin is betrayal of a friend or superior. Now, in this way, it's domestic, but it would be the same thing. The wife who betrays her husband is betraying someone who should have loved her and was a rightful authority over her, in which case it is one, again, it's the violation of authority. Okay, so it's the violation of that hierarchy, but it is also a sin against charity and of a very particular kind. And once the subject betrays the prince, the wife betrays the husband, the chain is broken. There's a curious essay, and I remember reading it in high school by E.M. Forster. And at the end, he's talking about someone who, he's comparing betrayals. Someone who betrayed a friend and someone who was a traitor to the state. And he says, and looking in my own life, I certainly would hope that I would find it easier to betray my country than I would ever find it to betray a friend. And even when I read that in high school, I thought, there's something really wrong there, because if you're betraying your country, you can't count on a friendship. In a sense, at that point, friendship becomes meaningless. So that the social good is essential. Without it, everything else dissolves. Everything else dissolves. By the way, that as I said, Dante puts Brutus and Cassius down there. Shakespeare's great tragedy, Julius Caesar, is about that. A wonderful, complex play. I mean, Caesar has his flaws, but in Shakespeare's vision, Caesar is the legitimate authority. And when Cassius seduces Brutus into joining the movement, and Brutus betrays his rightful ruler and his friend, it is a double betrayal. It's a horrible thing, and Brutus pays. And there are those who debate that play and say, well, Brutus is really the hero, and he has to do it. Shakespeare's Julius Caesar is one of the great indictments of liberalism. Because the reason Brutus gives is, well, Caesar's fine now, but in the future he might become a bad ruler, therefore it's better to kill him now. It's just an astonishing twist of mind. It's a horrific vision of corrupted reason. A great play. If you don't know Julius Caesar, read it. It's a very great play. Very complex play. But you get the same thing again. It's that kind of a double betrayal. Double betrayal.